I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast.
Thank you. Hello, welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast, a part of the Agora Podcast Network. I'm your host, Heather Tesco, and I'm assisted today by the lovely
Hannah
Tesco.
She's my mama.
I'm her mama. And this is a supplemental episode that we did. It was a chat that we did with Brigitte Webster in the Tutor Learning Circle a couple weeks ago, with her talking about what our tutor friends would have been doing to get ready for winter. At this time of year, there was a lot of work to do to get ready for winter, and Brigitte is talking about it. So you can find out about the live chats we do if you join the free Tutor Learning Circle, tutorlearningcircle.com. I know a couple of you have already requested access, and I just need to go in and approve it. I'm sorry for that. So I hope you enjoy this chat with Brigitte on how the tutors would have been preparing for winter. And hop on into the Tutor Learning Circle for more live chats. We just had our Tutor Tea Party, Christmas Tea Party, and it was lovely. We had chats with Carol Ann Lloyd, and Brigitte talked about Christmas food, so I'll be posting that here soon as well. All right, enjoy the chat.
It brings it home to you that people really had to live by the season. And one thing I've noticed in particular is there is no room for error. You really have to go with the weather and the right time to do particular things. And if you miss it, that's it. So the most important thing for a Tudor home, any Tudors, whether they lived in a manor house or at the farm, was in the autumn, you checked your roof. Because you do get leaks, and if you don't sort them in the autumn, you're going to be very wet all winter long. So that always would have taken top priority. And for the first time in the 16th century, during Tudor England, they also had to maintain their chimney. Now, chimneys, as we know them, I have a lovely fire behind me, but that was a fairly new thing to the ordinary Tudor home. Before the early 1500s, you wouldn't have had any chimneys, but clearly chimneys have to be cleaned, especially in the autumn. Otherwise, they pose a huge fire risk. Mm-hmm. And it's all got to do with what you burn. Now, we again assume that all the Tudors all the time used firewood to burn in their chimneys. But by the 1500s, there are severe shortages of firewood in England. We don't generally think about that, but they were. It got so bad by Elizabethan times that they had to switch to coal, which brought all sorts of other problems with it. But if you burn wood as we do, well seasoned, generally you are okay, but as soon as you start burning unseasoned wood, that means it's not quite dry, it leaves a type of tar inside your chimney, and that will catch fire. And it is and was the reason for many house fires. So, you know, it makes a difference whether you get it right or wrong. Obviously, the other thing is you had to always prepare well ahead of where you were. So come autumn, people were already thinking about the spring. So what you did is you had to prepare the ground where you were growing your food for next year. And one of the things that people would have done is to sow beans, fava beans, so the type that you grew on the field, not in your garden. What they did in the autumn was generally things that they started well in the summer. For instance, they gathered herbs. They started to gather herbs in the summer. And now was the time when they were nicely dried and they could do something with it. And that was often left to the lady of the house to do. So she didn't get her hands dirty. She didn't do the maintenance in the garden. I do now, having no staff, you know, COVID. But that's something they did now. The other thing they did in the autumn was getting ready for the much shorter days. Now, here in England, it gets very, very dark by four at the very latest. On a rainy, dark day like today, 3:30, and it gets dark. So you can't go to bed at 3:30. You have to do things. So you need to make sure you've got adequate light. Now, in Tudor England, that was candles. And this was the season when a lot of candle making went on. Now, we are lucky we've got bee wax. Unfortunately, that was very, very expensive indeed. And most people had to use other sources like animal fat, which did the same job, but we know from accounts that it must have been a very, very unpleasant smell. And then you obviously have the rushlights. I've missed that one. I'm in trouble. We have rush by our moat. I should have harvested that in August, dried it by October, and now sitting here dipping it into animal fat. But I was totally unaware, and I missed that opportunity, which will cost us dearly, because now we have to invest in bee wax. So not very good. The Tudors would not have been very impressed with me at all. Now, obviously, we have now talked about that you always had to think ahead. And the same was also for the food. Food, obviously, was their most and biggest concern. Throughout the winter months, you do not have as many access to fresh fruit as you would normally have throughout the rest of the year. The nobility had one big advantage because it was hunting season now. Hunting season starts now and goes right up to Christmas and a little bit after that. So obviously, Henry, as we know, he loved it. Elizabeth loved hunting. So lots of fresh meat coming in through hunting. But it was a meat you couldn't buy. You either had your own deer park, which actually was called a forest. So the English word forest actually means deer park. It does not mean a wood with lots of trees necessarily. And if you didn't have such a deer park, or you had no good friends who had one, you could not obtain any venison or any game.
Can I just interrupt?
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you, that's like the New Forest was such a, that was like where Henry went hunting a lot, right? It was like absolutely. In the New Forest, and that's where that whole thing came from.
Yes, yes. And it obviously the New Forest, named New Forest, was one that wasn't necessarily open as a deer park then. And it caused a lot of trouble for the people who lived there, because you weren't allowed to go into a forest, because a forest was private. So you weren't even allowed to go and gather firewood, where in a normal wood, you were allowed to do those things. So to turn any land from a wood into a forest caused major problems for the ordinary people. But as we know, their life didn't always matter, sadly. But November in particular was also the season where a lot of domestic animals like pigs would have been slaughtered. Now, I hear a lot that people assume all animals come November, and the 11th of November was a classic day when that was started. I just quickly have to check on my fire. It's okay, I just heard it go. right, so the 11th of November, Martinmas, was generally, traditionally, the day when the slaughter of the animals started. But that was really only done up to the late medieval times, when food was really scarce for the animals as well. So they pretty much automatically killed any livestock in November and then preserved it to last them through the winter. But interestingly, in the 16th century, things are beginning to change, and you can clearly detect an attempt in leaving all animals alive as long they possibly could. Because obviously come spring, if you killed off all your livestock, you had to go out and buy new ones. Especially with chickens, you wouldn't necessarily want to do that, because chickens supplied you not just with meat, but also with the eggs and obviously chicks, new ones. And the same goes for beef. Yes, it is true. If you compare England with the other countries in Europe, we did eat more beef here in comparison, but still, it was a big thing to kill your cows, which supplied you with milk, and the ox was needed as a tool, basically pulling your plow. So you really thought hard and long before you did that. So Tudors really tried to not slaughter animals unless they had to, except for the pig. Because the pig really was only, its sole purpose was to be eaten. And therefore, not many pigs made it through the winter. There's definitely good evidence that most of them did get slaughtered in November. And then they needed to prepare that meat for Christmas, because pork was one of the main Christmas meats, and the most important one. One of them, for instance, was brawn. Brawn is a fairly salty piece of pork. The Tudors loved it, absolutely loved it. It appears almost at all menus around Christmas. I tried it once, and that was the only thing where all of us, the whole family, agreed, no, never again. It really is so salty, but it had to be, because the way how they prepared it is once the pig was slaughtered, the meat got chopped up and then put in a very salty brine solution for 15 days. And that makes it really, really salty. Okay, it keeps that much longer. There are accounts of beef in brine lasting 2-3 months. Some even claim up to April. I'm not trying it. You know, there are limits to what I will attempt in order to find out whether it's possible or not. That is.
Can I just ask you a question? Can I step in here? Because something that you said made me want to ask you to follow up on that. So you said about how people by the Tudor period were trying to not kill their animals through the winter. What kind of advances in like food, like how did they feed them then? Because isn't the problem just how are you going to feed them through the winter? So what changed that allowed them to be able to, because presumably nobody would have wanted to slaughter their animals if they could have kept them.
True. But, you know, a lot of the things that people did was based on tradition. It always has been done like this. So change took a long time to really get going. But one of the things is temperatures slightly changed. And especially the early Tudor period actually was very good in terms of constant food supply. And that included the animals. For instance, hay. The summers were generally dry, or as dry as you can expect in England, and warm. So you had lots of crop that you could rely on being ready come autumn. Animals were generally fed with hay, but also parsnips, turnips. There was a time when people didn't eat those, but more fed them to their animals. And obviously pigs, we all know, were led into the wood to pick up any nuts, chestnuts, or any nuts whatsoever. So they used all of what nature provided. And if there was plenty of grass, and we do have some winters in England where you could actually have grass all through the winter. I think they also started to manage their animals better. It's all down to experience as well and trying out new approaches. The 16th century, when you look at food and how food was provided, there are such a lot of new tendencies coming in. And people at the forefront obviously had to prove, like today, you know, that this is good. Let's try it. Yes, there might be a little bit more risk involved, but you can always slaughter your sheep or lamb later on if you do run out of food, but give it a go, try it. And the other thing is animals also kept or helped to keep small farmhouses warm, because we often forget that small dwellings often had the domestic animals still at that time live in the same house. So if you get rid of your animals, it is going to be that much colder inside. So it's a balancing act. What I found interesting is this year I have tried to follow instructions on how to pick apples and pears and take them through, as they say, right up to March. And it's really interesting because it's clear that they did not have the scientific understanding why fruit would go rotten. But they knew that what they had to do is provide an airy surrounding for the apple or the pear, but keep it dry, but not too dry. And what they did is, and a lot of the farmers' instructions tell you very clearly how to put the pears or the wardens and the apples into the straw and how they had to constantly go back and twist them slightly round, changing them to make sure that every bit of apple or fruit had access to fresh air, that the fresh air had to circulate around the fruit without it getting wet, and obviously without mice damage. And so far, I'm doing good. I still got apples that look very nice, and pears. So yeah, it is really interesting because I didn't think they would last, but we'll see. We'll see.
And then after that, how would they store them through the winter?
That's it. That's what they did. Oh, okay. They had them somewhere cool but dry, lying on straw, so a soft surface.
Just like pickle them or anything?
And that's what I'm going to try this time round. How long I can keep them going before I lose one or two. It will be interesting because different instructions claim different degrees of success. I am convinced it also depends on the particular type of apple or pear. Some, like the wardens, were famous for never going off, but then again you couldn't eat them raw either. you had to cook them to soften them. So, yeah.
And by the end, during the 16th century, sugar becomes more popular, right? So would they have been canning anything, or like not the modern, the Elizabethan equivalent of canning?
Yes. Well, the first preserves are actually hundreds and hundreds of years old, but they used honey. So what they did, they immersed a whole fruit completely inside honey, so no bacteria, no air, nothing could get to it. And with the arrival of cheaper sugar, in England they always had sugar. Sugar starts to appear really early on, I think in the 1300s, but by then it was imported all the way from India, all the way through Venice and so on. So by the time it got to England, it really was expensive, and it was only a spice, so they couldn't preserve with sugar, not even the wealthy. In the 15th century, we are beginning to get sugar from European countries like Cyprus. The Portuguese start planting sugar cane in Madeira, for instance. So we get sugar through those countries, but it still is just too expensive to have large amounts at your disposal to preserve fruit. It was really only when the Portuguese and the Spanish took the sugar cane to the Caribbean and also Brazil. Those were the two places where they first started to plant them. And as we know, they did very well. The Spaniards and the Portuguese, to start with, used the locals to look after those plantations, but managed to, well, almost kill all of them, either due to hard work or a disease. And it was only in the mid 16th century then they started to import, sadly, African slaves to take over and do the work. So sugar came at a huge price. I think the figure I've got in my head is 10 1,000 people. Now, that is a lot when you think 16th century. You know, it might not be a lot today, but in 16th century terms, that is just criminal. But it made sugar a lot more cheaper. I mean, still out of reach of the normal people. But if you were nobility and you had a steady income and you wanted to show off, you could now for the first time import sugar in bigger quantities. So honey was replaced with sugar. And it's the late 16th century, so we're talking Elizabethan times, that we get cookery books that specifically now concentrate on making preserves. And those preserves are for the first time ever mostly geared at fruit and how to make it last. So you get the first types of marmalade, which is nothing like our marmalade now. I don't know whether people have seen it before. It would have looked something like this. You can pick it up. See, it's not even sticky. This one is made from quince. Because the first marmalade was made from quince. It came from Portugal, actually. And the Portuguese, I understand, for quince is marmelo. I hope I pronounce it fairly correctly. If not, I do apologize. But that's where the name marmalade comes from. So they used lots of sugar to make marmalades. But also all sorts of candied fruit, candied flowers was particularly popular. That's the one thing I'm still working on, to candy flowers. It's not that easy, actually, when you follow those very early recipes. But yes, they candied almost everything. Roots, for instance, the most famous one is the one from a plant called sea holly, which is a kind of thistle. Magnificent blue flower in the summer, but they used the root and they candied the root. I've tasted it. Well, yeah, you can eat it. It's not chocolate, no. But yeah, so sugar was definitely a very important preserving medium. But salt was still very important. And we mustn't forget vinegar. Vinegar was definitely another one. And I think it's very important because that's what was available to the common people. Vinegar could be produced homemade. Here in England, they would have used very tiny wild apples called crab apples. And they made vinegar, very mild vinegar, by the name of Virtus. In Italy, they made the same, but they used grapes instead, unripe grapes. And that vinegar, together with salt, was used to pickle almost everything. Obviously, we know vegetables like cucumbers. Samphire is another one. Samphire is actually hugely interesting because it's a very local vegetable that grows along the coast. And now, living so close to the coast, I can get it. Even today, it's lovely. But they also pickled walnuts, they pickled meat, fish, but fish, we still do have the pickled, the herring, you know.
Pickled herring.
One thing I quickly want to go back to is the famous stock fish. Simply because it played such a huge role in food preservation. Now, stockfish, we know because that's what most people ate through Lent when meat was not allowed. Now, the interesting thing about stockfish is how they prepared it. The most common one was fished as far as Iceland, which is extraordinary. So English fishermen traveled in the spring all the way first to Ireland and then passed right up to Iceland. And there on their boats, they first salted the fish and then dried them there, because you can only do that in those very cold but dry parts of Europe. It wouldn't work, not even down here in England. It's too warm here already. But it's amazing to think that the vast quantities of stockfish made from cod came as far as Iceland, and that in the 16th century. You then obviously also had the red herring and the white herring. That was produced in England. Again, they produced, you needed salt. So the herring, for the white herring, the salt, the herring was put into salt water, left there for a few hours, and then again was packed solid into barrels of quite coarse salt. It had to be very coarse salt, because otherwise you would have had to use a lot more in quantity, and it had to be a cheap but effective way. So they used really coarse but often not very clean salt. I've got a little bit here just in case you can see it's not even white, and it's quite coarse. So that was the white herring. People sometimes ask, so what was the red herring then? It was basically a white herring that they then put up for drying, not in the fresh air, but in little smoking huts. And by being smoked for days on end, sometimes weeks, apparently they changed the color into a touch of red, and therefore the red herring.
How funny. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. The people asked me so many times, and every time I thought, God, I have to find out what the difference is, because I didn't know. I thought at some stage it must be two different types of herring, but no, it's not. It's just the red herring was smoked.
Yeah. Okay. So people right now are Tudor friends in December are thinking, right? Anything else that they're doing?
Right, let me quickly have I think I've, oh, yes, there was. Haha, good thing you asked. It's always the thing when you just have a chat, you do forget vital bits, don't you? Butter, one of my favorite topics, butter. Because Tudor England did not use butter to spread on their bread. That was something the Dutch immigrants introduced the English to in late Elizabethan times. No, the English used butter only for the preservation of meat. Now, what they did is, I'll show you something quickly. So they cooked their meat very, very briefly, just to close the pores. Then they packed the meat into an earthenware pot called a galley pot. So that's galley pot. It's called a galley pot because these vessels came via galleys from Venice and the term stayed. So the meat was very briefly put into hot water just to close the pores. And then it was put into these galley pots and sealed with liquid salted butter. what it does is it makes sure no bacteria and no air can get to the meat. And apparently that's the only purpose of butter in Tudor England. And so far, and I've done a lot of research that backs it up, I have not been able to find out any recipes that use a butter to any great quantities. So every now and then they use butter for cooking, especially late Elizabethan recipes seem to have butter, a little bit of a knob of butter to go into their meat dishes. But generally, in early Tudor times, it was mostly used for preserving meat. But another typical Christmas fashion of preserving meat was actually the pie. The pie, again, was serving a purpose, not just eating. It was referred to in early Tudor times as the coffin. What a name, eh? Coffin, you're eating a coffin. No, you didn't. That's the interesting thing. In early Tudor times, the pastry only served as a cooking vessel because it was a dough made out of flour and water. Very tough, not tasty at all, but it was very strong. And they made the casing, put the meat in particular venison, and then put a lid on, so another pastry lid on top, and they cooked the meat in that vessel. And it was the most effective way to cook something and retain all the juices, but also it made it last because you didn't have to eat the pie then and there. You could cook it 2 weeks. Some recipes claim it lasts 2 months. And there was actually, let me quickly see whether I can find that. There is, where was it? Oh, yes, it must have been very effective because there is one case in the Woolerton household up in, I think they were in Leicestershire, but correct me if I'm wrong. But in 1587, so we are talking Elizabethan times, the family bought a loin of veal and made two pies. The first one they ate on the 18th of March and the second one on the 15th of April.
Wow.
So, yeah, okay, it might not be the most effective fridge as such, but it clearly lasted 4 weeks. And with meat, that's quite something, isn't it?
Yeah.
Another little thing I came that made me laugh and I came across yesterday. Somebody asked me about Brussels sprouts, you know, being talking about Christmas food and so on. They said, well, did the Tudors have Brussels sprouts for Christmas? And the quick answer is no. They didn't have Brussels sprouts because they were only really sort of invented or they were more, I call it an accident actually, because what happened is, I have read numerous accounts how they stored cabbage. Now what they did is they obviously in, around this time, they harvested the cabbage and then they hang it upside down from a ceiling. So you have the cabbage hanging down with the root system up there. And apparently, if you allow the cabbages to hang like that for a few months, so throughout the winter, the plant will produce tiny little sprouts along the stem. And it was the people in what today we understand as Belgium who observed that and thought, I wonder whether we could cultivate that somehow. And that's how it came about. They observed something that preserving showed them, and I thought, we wonder if we can actually do something. And that's how Brussels sprouts came about. But the first account of that, I think, goes back to 1547, when a Dutch botanist does actually name them for the first time. And because he was living in Belgium, it was called Brussels sprouts. But it did not make it to England that quickly. It took another, as so often, it took another few centuries for it to make it to England. So, no. But I thought it was interesting that they were able to come out with new vegetables just by looking into the old techniques.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that is, we have now actually covered all the different preservation methods. Yeah. Yeah, that is it. This is what it is. No ice house, no. Ice houses only started to appear in this late 17th century, so a good 100 years later.
Okay, well, so if people have questions for Brigitte about getting ready for winter or anything in general about cookery, you can either type them, or if you want to raise your hand, you can unmute. And let's see. Anne, I don't know if you meant to unmute. If you did,
yes,
please. Yeah, there she is. Okay.
You mentioned pickled nuts. I've pickled vegetables before. How do you pickle nuts?
The same way as everything else. You basically have to make up a concoction between brine and vinegar. And you just put it in the glass. Most recipes of the time actually mention a glass, something like this. This is actually a 16th century glass. And they put it in there, and then used waxed linen like this. So it's just basically a piece of linen cloth, which they cover in wax. And when it cools down, you can then put it neatly over there and with a string hold it tight. And that's how they would have pickled anything, even nuts, walnuts. All the recipes I have come across do use walnuts. So I don't know whether it means that hazelnuts or other nuts are not suitable, but I guess it's more because walnuts were used for cookery, where hazelnuts were a snack.
Yeah, so, Monica has her hand up. Let's see. Go ahead, Monica.
I have a question about fires. Do they? I know in like Ireland they would use the peat moss, and then also like in the West here in America we would use like buffalo chips. Was any vegetation or refuge used like that as fires?
Yes, absolutely. Peat was one, definitely, especially in the areas that are fairly low, like Norfolk here and Suffolk. But peat had to be harvested in the summer and then dried, because when you try and burn it when it's still a little bit damp, it doesn't burn very well, and obviously is also very unpleasant in producing smoke. They also used a kind of bracken, so a type of fern dried, but that was more something that common people used. Charcoal was made almost on every single estate, and apparently was a very clean way, a very clean material to use for burning and also cooking. But confusingly, they called charcoal coal, just like the mineral coal. So when you do research, it's often exceptionally hard to be decisive. Is this now the mineral coal, which started to be used in Elizabethan times, especially in areas like Yorkshire, where they used it for industrial purposes, but as firewood or woods generally started to be a problem in them, it was so much deforested here, they started to also use coal, so the mineral coal, which brought all sorts of problems, not for the new houses that had a proper built chimney so much, but a lot of the smaller houses still had their main fire in the centre of the living area, and any wood smoke used to disappear through the roof and the rafters, because wood doesn't produce a lot of smoke if it's well dried and seasoned, but coal does. Coal also produces a lot of very unpleasant ash that is really difficult to get rid of. So using coal was bad news, and people did complain. When you go through original sources, you come across a lot of people complaining and saying this coal is no good. So when they complain, you know it's true coal, the mineral they're referring to, because charcoal would not have caused the same problems. And they also used dung. Cow's dung, and it had a name, but you know what, I can't remember it now, but it had a name, and apparently when it was dry it was okay. Not sure when I want to try it on my fire though, but yeah that dung was also used.
Perfect. You know what? We're just at about an hour now, and I know a lot of people are doing this while they're eating lunch and on the East Coast. So I think we'll let people go back to work and go back to stuff. But Brigitte, you are fabulous. Where can people buy your book and learn more about you and come visit you and all that? Plug your stuff.
Yes. Oh, I actually have been approached by a publisher who want me to, well, they want me to write a book on how to feed the Tudors and the history of the food that the Tudors ate. So
but you do have your book that your banquet at Old Hall, right?
Yes. I do have that.
People can write to you if they want to know about that. Awesome. Somebody said very informative. Thanks, Brigitte and Heather. Thank you so much, Brigitte. It was so informative. Super awesome. Thank you so much for being part of this and for stopping by and for saying hi and for sharing your knowledge and everything like that. Very grateful.
Aww. Yeah. Thank you for watching me.
I could watch you all day. And you're going to be at TudorCon next year, right?
Yes. You know, it will be that much more special because we had to, well, all undergo the plague. Yes. It's all actually right. One of the things I'm looking into this year, how people coped in times of plague.
Yeah.
It's very
interesting. Yeah. All right. So awesome. Thank you so much. And we'll just wish everybody a good rest of your day. Have a good evening, Brigitte. Have a good everything wherever you are.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bye.
Good night.
Night. Bye.
Thanks for listening. We'll
talk to you again
soon. We'll talk to you again soon. Merry Christmas.
All right.
And Happy New Year.
Awesome.
We'll be back again soon. Thanks for listening.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders that we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.